Linda Carlson.
General Taylor, I regret sincerely that I was unable to be here when you read your prepared statement. I had the honor of attending the President's prayer breakfast this morning and presiding. But I have read it since coming to this meeting, and it does raise one or two questions, and I hope my questions can be like Senator Aiken suggested. They might add something to this. I don't know that they will. I believe you stated in response to the Senator of Vermont that you hoped to use, or you were not using your Air Force outside of Vietnam. Is that correct?
I was commenting on the fact that in 1961, although we were perfectly aware that North Vietnam was the source of the support of the insurgency, we did not recommend the airstrikes outside of the country, hoping to be able to cope with the situation within the confines of South Vietnam.
Well, the reason I bring it up is that I have here a dispatch from Saigon, dated February 15th, and I shall not read it. It's written by Jack Poise, a Los Angeles Times reporter. It reads this way: the U.S. Air Force has stepped up its attack on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos by using spray planes to destroy foliage with chemicals. My only reason for bringing it up, I wondered if this is an escalation or expansion of the war outside of what we've been calling our Vietnam area.
I'm not aware of this operational activity, Senator. We have been flying armed reconnaissance for a long time with the agreement of the Laotian government. Whether that the reference is to that kind of activity, frankly, I'm not sure.
But this would be, if this statement is correct, either an escalation or expansion of the war into another country.
Escalation suggests, I believe, a rather dramatic change in tactics or strategy. I would say it's simply an extension of the kind of thing we're doing in the North, namely limiting the infiltration of men and supplies.
Well, is it not a fact, however, that much of the material and supplies does come through Laos from the northern area, and this probably is one section of the war theater that could be helpful if we could prevent it. But the question gets to be, again, are we going into Laos and other areas?
Certainly it'd be very important if we could stop the movement of supplies in Laos. Again, we all know the limitations of what air can do, even if there are no restrictions placed upon its employment.
Well, I noticed in your statement, and I believe it's on page 10, you said something about, it's perfectly clear from the start, as it's clear today, that air power would not be able to stop infiltration. Well, I was just wondering if this is the beginning of an expansion of the air power into those areas. Not only the entire war effort. Mm-hmm.
I have no knowledge of any change of decision.
Then I want to get to another sentence that I read about the expansion of the use of our troops. I believe that you talk about, I am thoroughly aware of the concern of this country over the growing requirement for American troops in South Vietnam. And then you ask this question, is this enough? Endless requirement in an open-ended war. You go through and say, I do not believe that anyone can give a complete satisfactory reply to this question, but I can suggest the consideration of certain limiting factors which have a bearing on this matter. There is, I think, in progress, of course, an increase in the number of our troop strengths. And I just want to ask this question. Can we triple, for instance, our troop strength in Vietnam without cutting back on our troop commitments in Europe and Korea?
That would mean raising the troop level to around 600,000?
Well, a substantial amount at least.
I would say that we would have to call up some of our reserves. It all would depend upon the reaction at home. If indeed we raised additional forces, we could support this strength and also our commitments overseas, but not with our present military establishment.
Would you be required then to call up the reserves if we should go that far, in your opinion?
Only Secretary McNamara could answer that officially, but I would certainly assume so if it went to 600,000. Some reserve, selective reserve.
Here I get back to Senator Aiken again. He said you don't quote one general with another's views, but I was interested in the comment by General Gavin. He told us that in his opinion, if we become further involved to the extent of vastly increasing our troop strength, that the Chinese would surely open up in Korea. Do you have any comment on that?
It's purely a matter of opinion. Neither one of us can prove our case. I would not agree with that. There are so many reasons why the Red Chinese would want to avoid a military confrontation with us. And, of course, on our side, we're not certainly not seeking one. Since both parties would be against a military confrontation, I would be surprised if it arose. There is always some risk, as I conceded in my statement. But when you look at the problems of China, their enormous population food problem, their extreme vulnerability to air attack, to the fact that they can't afford to have their own strength diminished in relation to the Soviet Union, and with whom they're engaged in a bitter competition, and all these factors are looked at, it seems to me that the likelihood of deliberate military involvement in confrontation of the United States on the part of Peking is unlikely.
Well, again, I want to get back to a press dispatch. As a member of the United States Senate, and I suppose our citizens generally, we read these correspondence and reports that come from all over the world, and I was interested to see one from Paris, February 15th. And this is written by Waverly Root of the Washington Post Foreign Services. And I shall not, it's a rather lengthy article, but it's an interesting article in regard to a letter. And maybe I'd better read just a sentence or two. President de Gaulle has told President Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam that there is no military solution to the Vietnam War and that France will act to help a peace effort when the time is ripe, which he does not think is now the case. I assume, based on some previous answers you've made, you have some question as to whether this is a time.
I simply don't believe that the Hanoi leadership has got in the frame of mind that they're likely to bring him to the peace table with a sincere determination to seek a solution.
Well, I shall read the next paragraph. De Gaulle's views were put forth in a letter sent to Hanoi February 8th, but published here today. This is Paris. It was a reply to a letter from Ho of January 24th. And this is a lengthy article, and I'd like to ask Mr. Chairman to put the entire article so that I don't see any question about it. I bring this up because it states in here that the officials of the United States government have been advised of this letter and this correspondence, and as with your position in the policy-making positions of our government, are you familiar with this letter and their suggestion that he would act and on what basis he would act?
No, sir, I'm not familiar with the letter.
It's a rather interesting article and gets into the suggestion that the American people, the leadership of our nation, have been advised of this offer and these two letters of correspondence. I think that's important for this reason, that there's a sincere hope in our nation that we can reach negotiations. Now, I know there's some feeling against President de Gaulle in this nation. That's a subject matter for any of us to discuss. But at the same time, they are the one nation that has had some great experiences with the Vietnam people and that area. And it seems to me that if he has made a suggestion here and has any thought of being in contact with Ho Chi Minh and being able to work out any suggestions, I would hope that you, as one of the men in the high-ranking positions of the policy and others in the government, would take a sincere look at it.
Well, I'm quite sure the responsible officials will, sir, if there is such a letter.
General, it's a pleasure to have you before the committee. For men such as yourself, General Gavin, Mr. Keenan, Mr. Bell, to appear before this committee and by television before the American people is an event in which I believe many people will take pride. I thought your prepared text was the ablest presentation of the administration's policy that I have read.
Thank you.
And I congratulate you. I was pleased to note that in your first paragraph, you say, "I agree thoroughly with the motivating purpose of these hearings." And then you name some of the purposes I'd like to cite. You say, "To analyze the reasons why we are involved in South Vietnam, the importance of this involvement, and the effectiveness with which we are dealing with the resultant problems. Would you think, in addition to those stated purposes, that a proper motivating purpose would be an examination of those resultant problems, what additional problems might result?
Yes, sir. I think those would be thoroughly legitimate addition to the statement, Arlen.
And would you think public enlightenment upon the question involving war and peace would also be
yes,
a proper?
Yes, sir.
And you take the view, I take it, that such an examination through our democratic processes is a proper exercise in a self-governing society.
Yes, I certainly do, sir.
I would add one other purpose, General, though I do not claim that I can speak for the whole committee. It seems to me that the prime purpose of these hearings must be to contribute to the formulation of policy and objectives in this distraught situation on which the American people and their government can be unified. Would you think that a laudable objective?
Yes, sir. In my prepared talk, of course, I tried to lay out what I understood our basic objective to be.
And you did quite well.
Our strategy to do it, and of course, I feel we're on the right course.
And you did quite well in that effort. Now, in an effort to come to this central issue of the formulation of a policy and the unifying of the people, I would like to come to the objectives which you describe. If you would turn to page 12 of your statement, near the end of the page, you describe your policy, the administration policy. Quote from your statement: "It is limited as to objective, as to geographical scope, as to weapons and forces employed, and as to targets attacked." Now, I would like to read you short sentences, from a statement which I made on the floor of the Senate yesterday, and then perhaps if we can understand what your objectives are, we can understand what the limits are, perhaps we can be moving toward some unity which is badly needed. And I'd like, before reading this, to say that I'm apprehensive that as the war has been widened, the gap between the President and the Congress has been widened, and unrest among our people has risen. So this hearing may contribute wonderfully well if we can bring some modification of policy or some understanding of policy on the part of the administration and an enlightenment of the people as to that. Now, I'd like to read this brief statement which I made and then reread the one you've just made and solicit your comment. This is a statement I made. "I advise that this war be kept within bounds which appear manageable, with limited goals and limited commitments," which you say we have. "That goal being a tolerable political arrangement that would permit honorable disengagement of United States combat forces at the earliest feasible time. Once again, I advise against a wider war, against a commitment to total victory in a major war in Asia. Here, it seems to me, is the great issue now under debate." Now, let me read your statement and you point out the differences, if you will. And what are the limits and what are the objectives? Here's your statement describing the policy. Quote, "It is limited as to objective, as to geographical scope, as to weapons and forces employed, and as to targets attacked." Now, there ought to be an area of agreement here between these two. Will you comment on where the divergences are and the areas of agreement?
I would think that there is indeed very little separating us, although, of course, the interpretation of certain words can be important. The meaning of my sentence is this, that our objective is the one which I have stated at the outset, using the language of the president, that it's a free and independent South Vietnam, no longer threatened by communist aggression. From the point of view of Hanoi, then, it is not the destruction of Hanoi. It's not the abject capitulation of Hanoi. It's not unconditional surrender. It's not the giving up of a communist form of government. All of these things can be retained by Hanoi as long as they stop the aggression against the South. As to geographical scope, we originally limited for years the use of military action within the confines of South Vietnam itself. Now we have embarked on this very carefully controlled, very limited use of our air power against military targets in the north. Very much of a limited employment of air power. As to the weapons and forces employed, we have certainly limited the type of weapons to our conventional weapons. No one is talking about the use of nuclear weapons, for example. We have limited the use of our ground forces to South Vietnam and are not contemplating the use in the north in Vietnam. And certainly the targets being attacked are very carefully chosen as military targets, making a maximum effort to avoid all civilian destruction.
Now, I'd like to ask you about your limitation of forces. None of us can be certain as to what part the size of an American Expeditionary Force will have upon the determination of the Red Chinese. General MacArthur, I recall, said that American forces could go to the Yalu without the Chinese coming in Korea. You were in Korea. Did you share that estimate of General MacArthur?
I was not in Korea at the time. I was in Berlin, far from this immediate problem, so I had no chance.
I withdraw the question, and I thought you were in Korea. Well, you said on television last Sunday that you did not think the Chinese would come into Vietnam. I hope you're right.
Of course, the situation is quite different.
I understand. Now, what was the largest number of American soldiers in Korea?
I would have to get the book on that.
I have the figures
but
from
the total strength along the front was something under 1 million men, including
Koreans. It's a great deal less than that, General. I have a statement from the Defense Department that it's the highest number of American soldiers on the scene at any one particular time was 281,000.
I said the entire force on the front to include the Koreans.
I asked you the number of American soldiers.
Well, I think your figure, if that's from the Defense Department,
281,000.
Yeah.
Well, now, Senator Russell said on the floor of the Senate yesterday that we had approximately 300,000 involved in Vietnam now. He included, I must point out, the naval forces that are offshore. But I believe actual foot soldiers in Vietnam is now something more than 200,000, is it not?
The total military population permanently in Vietnam, the last figure I saw, was 205,000. It may have changed slightly.
So we are already involved, insofar as our own forces are concerned, in the order of the Korean War.
In quite a different sense, Senator, so much of this American strength is really backup to support the very large Vietnamese force of 677,000. A great deal of the logistic support, the air support, and that kind of thing, is necessary because we have such a large ally with forces in being and forces in combat.
Well, now, can you enlighten us as to the limits of the forces which you have in mind? You say you have careful limits as to weapons and forces.
Well, I rather suggested in my prepared text why I didn't think there was an endless requirement for American ground combat forces, making the point that because of logistic limitations, which are contributed the effects of our air, that I felt that the North Vietnamese had a finite number of forces that could be sustained. And then I pointed out that if we take as our military objective on the ground the destruction of those mainline Viet Cong battalions without taking as the objective the occupation of all of this country or pursuing every guerrilla to the most remote lair in the jungle, that then the military requirement becomes something that we can cope with.
Well, I appreciate that statement, and I must point out that it's very general. And one of the causes of our trouble here, I think, General, is we've had creeping escalation. The Congress, some members may know what the administration plan is, but most of us have been left in the dark. Now, let me call your attention that a very distinguished and able senator, Senator Stennis, made a speech recently in which he referred to the possible sending of 600,000 American troops to Vietnam. Then last week, before this committee, or as a member of this committee, the very able senior senator from Missouri, former Secretary of Air, made this statement. There has been mention, I'm quoting Senator Symington now, there has been mention of a figure of 600,000 people in South Vietnam by the distinguished senator from Mississippi, chairman of the Preparedness Subcommittee. That figure did not originate with him. It came from the highest military authority in a hearing before the Armed Services Committee. Are you acquainted with the plans for 600,000 referred to here?
No, sir. There's no reason why I would be. I'm not suggesting they're not plans. If my old colleagues at the Joint Chiefs of Staff do as I did, you have a whole stack of plans at various cutoff points, not knowing exactly which plans are going to be implemented.
I'm just handed a note that my time's expired. I want to come back, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to trying to delimit these objectives. What are the objectives? What are the limits? Is this to be a limited war or a global war? This is where the real issue lies.
Senator Williams.
Chairman, time being our pass.
Senator Lauch.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. General Taylor, as a premise to my questions, which first will be directed in trying to ascertain with what country the brutality lies, I want to read to you from the book written by Truong Chinh of North Vietnam in describing what the revolutionary activity should be. The traitors to the nation, reactionaries, and enemies of the resistance must be immediately eliminated. We should punish those even in the ranks of the resistance who advocated wrong measures or committed harmful deeds. Step up extermination activities against traitors. All those refusing to have rice collected, to pay taxes, or make money available to the front shall be considered as reactionaries and punished as traitors. Finally, the aim of the revolution is to liberate our compatriots in South Vietnam. Now remember, this is a North Vietnamese speaking. The aim is to defeat the aggression and frustrate the warmongering policies of the United States imperialists and their lackeys. Now, with that preface, I direct my questions first to the subject of the attempt made this morning to place the United States government in the position of a colonial power wanting to exploit the economy and the resources and the people of South Vietnam. Who is the colonial power that has been referred to, if you can answer, General Taylor?
Well, we've discussed several colonial powers, France for one, and North Vietnam, the Hanoi leadership, is the new colonial power in this area.
Well, then, this effort, by innuendo and adroit reasoning, to imply that our government is the exploiter, as far as I'm concerned, cannot go unchallenged. In the fight that terminated in 54, was there or wasn't there a colonial power involved?
There was indeed, France.
And wasn't it because colonialism was the issue that the fight against colonialism grew intense and successful?
That is right.
Now then, you have listened to statements out of North Vietnam and from the Viet Cong. And may I ask if it isn't a fact that in their purpose of propaganda, they have labeled us as the imperialists and the exploiters?
Those terms are usually used.
I don't believe I've ever read a statement coming out of them on policy unless it contained the epithet, the imperialists of the United States. Have we taken anything out of South Vietnam or out of any of the Southeast Asia countries as distinguished from what we have been giving to help them build up their society and economy?
I think the president has made clear over and over again that not only have we not taken anything out in the past, we have no intention to seek permanent bases or any permanent relationships in this part of the world.
We have given definite assurance that we have no contemplation of destroying the North Vietnamese government. We want nothing from them except that they should stop their aggression against the peaceful citizens of South Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
Now, returning to this policy of torture, atrocities, have they destroyed deliberately the schools of the South Vietnamese?
In many cases. Would you allow me to pick up your original thoughts here, because you mentioned the activities in North Vietnam. I think we ought to remind ourselves frequently of what took place in 1954. I have a quotation here from one of our magazines that current at the time that described the actions of the communists in the North. What began simply as a gigantic muddle soon degenerated under the guidance of Truong Ching, who you mentioned, into a veritable bloodbath. The terrible popular tribunals were set up in the villages at which the landlords were judged by the infallible people. Judgment was usually followed by summary execution. Nobody knows how many died in this way. The policy was known by the sinister name of the mobilization of the masses. And I would suggest, as you are, Senator, that if indeed the Viet Cong ever had domination in the South, we'd see far greater slaughters, and our feelings certainly would be more harrowed than when we observed the Soviet action in Hungary a few years ago.
Based upon what I read as having been written by Truong Chinh, has his advice and doctrinaire been carried out in South Vietnam?
Terror is a regular tactic against the civil population, sir.
That is, mayors, chiefs are destroyed and kidnapped.
School teachers?
school teachers, schoolhouses blown down, buses destroyed. And that is done not only in the hundreds, but in the thousands. Am I correct in that?
That is correct, sir.
I read to you of an event that happened in June of 1965, following the Battle of Dong Hoai. The Viet Cong left behind about 1,500 of a total of 3,000 population. Dead, injured, maimed, or orphaned. These 3,000 people were simple Vietnamese peasants. The Viet Cong, before they withdrew, literally entered every single home, shack, habitation of any kind, and like locusts, cleaned out every last kernel of rice, every piece of dried fish, or any other protein, and every last container of Nuoc Mam, and cleansed out every last piaster. Are you familiar with that incident?
Not specifically, but I'm sorry to say those incidents are not rare.
Now, I've listened yesterday afternoon to an argument on the floor of the Senate. To my great pain, my colleagues attempting to lay the blame on our people and on our government that we are perpetrating these acts. General Taylor, in your connection with this problem, has there come to you, your attention, a single instance in which we have, under a policy such as promoted by the communists, carried into effect such atrocities?
Certainly, as a matter of policy, Senator, we do everything possible to spare the civilian population. General Westmoreland, as an able and humane man, has issued the clearest of instructions on utilizing military force insofar as the consideration of the population can be taken into account without the loss of people in action, that he will make every effort to spare them from the horrors of war. Unhappily, they do suffer, and it's impossible to have a civil war of this type. A war in which the enemy deliberately mingles themselves with the civilian population without civilian casualties in large numbers.
Now I come to another subject. The people of our nation are wanting to learn what course we ought to follow. I am one who is trying to determine what course will be in the best interest and the highest security of our nation. Preliminary to putting my question to you, I want to read the questions that I put to General Gavin when he testified here last week. Senator Lausche, do you feel we should stay in South Vietnam in the interest and the security of our country? General Gavin, yes, I do. Question. You believe that our security requires that we stay there. Is that correct? General Gavin, that is correct. Senator Lausche, and you are not advising the people of the United States that we should pull out. General Gavin, I certainly am not. Further question. The fact is that you believe that this latter course of staying in Vietnam and not withdrawing to Thailand or Cambodia or the Philippines is the course that we ought to follow? His answer is yes. I now go to the questions of that I put to Mr. Kennan.
Senator,
it's a bad time for time to be up as far as our cause is concerned, and a good time for the cause of those who disagree with me. I'll yield.
Well, it's the clock.
May I put these questions?
Yes. You can put them here.
Do you advise pulling out in just 2 minutes, 1 minute?
What are the questions here?
Would it be in the interest of the security of our country for us to pull out?
Just the contrary, it'd be disastrous.
A moment ago, in answer to questions put by some former senator, you said that if we did pull out, it would be regrettable.
I hope I used a stronger adjective.
What would you feel would happen if we did pull out? Would that be the end of our troubles?
I think it would just start our troubles on a worldwide basis. The repercussions would not be limited to Southeast Asia, but would affect every country with whom we have relations, particularly in all our alliances, which would be...
Now it's been advocated...
I have to interrupt the Senator Munt.
All right.